Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Forced landing. Belarus diverts an international flight to arrest a dissident journalist, prompting accusations of state piracy and terrorism. Then, 1 year later, the father of Michael Brown, killed in Ferguson, Missouri, reflects on how the country has and has not changed in the year since George Floyd's death. Plus, desperate journey, we follow one migrant's struggles to reach the U.S., escaping the violence and poverty of his home country.
I've heard from friends what you make in Honduras in 1 year, you make in 2 months in the United States. There you can go grocery shopping calmly. Here they will assault you or can even kill you. Life is so much better there for economic and security reasons.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The nation's largest school system will return to fully in-person learning this fall. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced it today. He said remote options will not be offered for the system's 1 million students. Meanwhile, Los Angeles schools also announced a return to full in-person learning come fall. Remote options there will be available in special cases. The World Health Organization warned today that unequal distribution of COVID-19 vaccines is prolonging the pandemic. In Geneva, the agency's head criticized what he called a scandalous inequity.
A small group of countries that make and buy the majority of the world's vaccines control the fate of the rest of the world. The number of doses administered globally so far would have been enough to cover all health workers and older people if they had been distributed equitably.
That warning came as India surpassed 300,000 deaths, third most in the world. The total included more than 4,400 deaths in just the last 24 hours. The country has been racing to accelerate vaccinations and testing. India is also bracing for its second tropical cyclone in just 10 days, this time battering the country's east coast. The storm is churning in the Bay of Bengal before an expected landfall on Wednesday, with winds of 100 miles an hour. Last week's storm killed at least 140 people on India's west coast. More than 170 children are still missing in eastern Congo, 2 days after a volcano erupted near Goma. At least 22 people have died, and more than 500 homes were destroyed as lava blanketed villages. Some 5,000 people were forced to flee. The city's volcano observatory says that government funding cuts prevented any advanced warning to the public. The deposed leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, appeared in court in person today for the first time since a military coup in February. State TV showed a still image. Suu Kyi's lawyer said she wanted her followers to know that her political party stands by them.
One thing she said is that her party grows out of the people, and wherever the people is, there must be, and there is necessarily be the body. The body may exist wherever the people is, she said.
Suu Kyi is charged with breaking a colonial-era secrets law, among other crimes. Her supporters say the proceedings are a sham and meant to discredit her. On Wall Street today, stocks started the week on the positive side, led by tech stocks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 186 points to close at 34,394. The NASDAQ rose 190 points. The S&P 500 added 41. And Phil Mickelson has etched a new entry in the annals of pro golf's history, the oldest player to win a major tournament at age 50. He tapped in on the 18th hole Sunday to claim the PGA Championship at Kiawa Island, South Carolina, by two strokes. It was Mickelson's sixth major championship overall. Still to come on the NewsHour, a string of anti-Semitic attacks raises tensions in the wake of the Israel-Gaza war. We follow the journey of one migrant's struggles to escape violence and reach the U.S. The father of Michael Brown reflects on what has changed since George Floyd's killing. how a Houston museum is widening its lens to showcase Latin American art, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today, the European Union slapped sanctions on Belarus one day after Belarusian authorities ordered what European leaders call a state-sponsored hijacking. Yesterday, a civilian airliner was forced to land in Minsk so authorities could arrest a journalist who had been critical of the regime. It's being called the biggest political crisis for global aviation in years. Here's Nick Schifrin.
When Ryanair 4978 was forced to land in Minsk, authorities didn't only remove the luggage. They also arrested 26-year-old Belarusian activist Ramon Pratasevich. He ran an online news service that helped organize mass protests against President Alexander Lukashenko. Known as Europe's last dictator, who's been in power 1 year longer than Pratasevich has been alive. Tonight, Belarusian authorities released a video of Pratasevich giving what appeared to be a scripted confession to organizing the protests. But today, Ryanair chief executive Michael O'Leary blamed the Belarusian government and said four Belarusian security agents were on board to ensure the hijacking succeeded.
I think it's the first time it's happened to a European airline, but I mean, this was a case of state-sponsored hijacking.
The flight path shows the plane flying in a straight line to intended destination Lithuania when it did a U-turn, landing instead in Minsk. State media said Lukashenko ordered a fighter jet to escort the plane to Belarus's capital. A bomb squad official in a balaclava explained how there might have been an explosive on board. But European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen dismissed that claim and accused the government of outrageous and illegal behavior and a hijacking. And today, at an EU summit, leaders ban Belarusian airlines from flying over EU countries or using EU airports. Lukashenko has been fighting for his political life since he arrested leading opposition figures last year ahead of what the international community called a stolen election. His regime has arrested many protest leaders and reporters who covered the uprising, but the Ryanair incident is unprecedented.
We just realized, I think, not just us at the Committee to Protect Journalists, but a lot of Belarus watchers realized how far Lukashenko can go.
Gulnaza Said is the Europe and Central Asia Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Pratasevich founded the Necta Forum and the Telegram app. It shares user-generated content from protests with millions of subscribers and help demonstrators avoid state censorship.
The free and live information and videos also that were being distributed on Necta became very, very important for Belarusians as the authorities were trying to close down or to control other media outlets who were providing the same sort of information.
Today, Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya said she feared for Pratasevich's safety.
He could be interrogated by KGB. He may be tortured now as an enemy of Lukashenko. We are dealing with the harshest regime in Europe in decades.
For more on this, we turn to Matthew Rajansky, the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, a Washington, D.C. think tank. Matthew Rajansky, welcome back to the NewsHour. Why would the Lukashenko regime consider Ramon Pratasevich such a threat?
A few reasons. First of all, Pratasevich has been in exile. He has had a suspended sentence or a sentence in absentia of 12 years for alleged terrorism against him for some time. So this is not new. But in the last several months, in the aftermath of the stolen August presidential election, which resulted in hundreds of thousands of people coming out of the streets of Minsk, the Telegram channel, the news service Nexta, which Pratasevich co-founded and has been instrumental in reporting on what's actually happening in Belarus, this has been viewed as a national security threat, a threat to the regime by the Lukashenko government in Minsk. And so the opportunity to snag this political opponent clearly was too tempting for them.
Yeah, the verb snag is pretty much what the Europeans have called it today. And tonight, we have seen the European Union announce new sanctions, including a ban on Belarusian airlines flying over EU countries and the use of Belarusian airlines in EU airports. What's the implication of that, and how effective is it likely to be?
Well, it's interesting in a couple of respects. One, it is proportionate in the sense that it's responding in terms of commercial air travel, which is where the violation was done. It's a violation of basic principles of commercial air travel, freedom of navigation, et cetera, that this plane was downed under false pretenses for political reasons, and the EU is responding in that dimension. Second, it's effectively isolating Belarus because this is a landlocked country surrounded by EU members and Ukraine, which, of course, is likely, I think, to go with the EU on this, and then only has an eastern border with Russia. And so this, in effect, doubles down on the political position that Lukashenko was in after his crackdown, which was to become wholly dependent on Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin. Now, in terms of literal physical access to the outside world via the Belarusian national air carrier, Belarus is in that position of total dependency on Russia.
You describe how this further isolates Belarus, but what leverage do the Europeans, do the Americans have to actually get Lukashenko to change his behavior?
The dilemma of Lukashenko's current position for the West is that he has chosen sides. When Lukashenko was bouncing back and forth between currying favor in the West, currying favor in Moscow, playing one against the other, one could have argued that limited pressure could achieve limited ends. For example, a certain amount of economic sanctions pressure, a certain amount of diplomatic pressure, naming and shaming, was able to get prisoners, political prisoners, released. At this point, having signed up essentially fully for Vladimir Putin's protection and abandoned any pretense of good relations with the West, it's hard to see how that kind of leverage is likely to be successful. Now, that said, give it a little bit of time, because I don't think Putin and Lukashenko view one another as reliable partners. They've had 20 years to work through that relationship, and they've never reached that point. So it is likely that in a few years, when there's a falling out and there's a reason for Lukashenko to change course again, you know, he'll seek to curry favor in the West by releasing these political prisoners, including perhaps Protasevich, who's, you know, got this 12-year sentence hanging over his head. So there's good reason for the West to impose those sanctions as leverage, but I would not expect quick success.
You and I have talked about authoritarianism increasing across the world, not only in Minsk. I wonder, has this kind of thing, this hijacking, as the Europeans have put it, ever happened before? And what message does it send to the rest of the world if Belarusian government believes that it succeeded?
This is being described across the board as unprecedented. Or frankly, if there's a precedent for it, it's a hijacking by a state. It is a state-sponsored act of terrorism. The Russians, of course, are backing Lukashenko. They're claiming that this sort of thing has been done by the West. There was a case in 2013. Evo Morales was leaving Russia, and no European country would refuel his aircraft, so he was forced down. I don't see a direct comparison there. I mean, this is an attempt to actually grab, to snatch out of midair, someone who's viewed as an enemy of the regime. It really is an act of terrorism.
And therefore, could we see it repeated by other countries, perhaps even by Moscow, which, to no surprise, has backed this effort?
I think the Russians view their territory in terms of absolute sovereignty. At this point, you know, although they certainly take part in international civilian air travel agreements, if they have reason enough to try to grab someone or target someone who's on an aircraft, think Alexei Navalny, they poisoned him intentionally just before he got on a civilian airliner. I think the Russians view their airspace as totally up for grabs, fair game for their political warfare against the opposition.
Matt Rudzianski of the Wilson Center, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The ceasefire in Gaza is holding for now. But while the confrontation between Israel and the Palestinian group Hamas was taking place, there were growing reports of anti-Semitic attacks and slurs in several American cities. William Brangham focuses on the disturbing questions this raises once again about intolerance and hate in America.
Judy, the Anti-Defamation League tracked reports of online comments, verbal confrontations, and physical assaults in the U.S. during that 11 days of bombing in Gaza and in Israel, finding, quote, a drastic surge in anti-Semitic language and attacks. That included an attack on a 29-year-old man in New York who was punched, kicked, and pepper sprayed in Times Square. In Los Angeles, five people suffered minor injuries after they were attacked by people waving Palestinian flags. In Tucson, Arizona, a synagogue was vandalized. The ADL also reported thousands of tweets or retweets that seemed to echo the phrase, "Hitler was right." Last week, five Jewish organizations, including the ADL, wrote a letter to President Biden about their concerns over this rise in these hateful attacks, asking him to speak out more forcefully against them. For more on all of this, we turn to Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. Jonathan, great to see you back on the NewsHour. In the past, your organization has documented that when there is violence between Israelis and Palestinians, that anti-Semitic attacks in the U.S. go up. Compared now to then, are we seeing more now?
Yes, it's certainly true that in the past, conflagrations in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians or its neighbors have created and or catalyzed an uptick of anti-Semitism in America. But what we're seeing now is more drastic and, frankly, more dangerous. The ADL tracked between the 2 weeks of the conflict and the 2 weeks before a 63% increase. And that surge is far greater than what we've seen in prior incidents, like 2014, for example. But what I'd also note is not just the quantitative, but the qualitative. The span of these attacks, they spread like wildfire across the country. You mentioned a few: California, Arizona, Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, New York, New Jersey, South Carolina, Florida. Acts of harassment and vandalism and violence. So number one, the span is much greater than what we've seen. But secondly, the tone, the brazenness, the audacity of these assaults in broad daylight. You know, we've seen people basically say, you know, if you're wearing a Jewish star, you must be a Zionist and you should be killed. We've seen people hurling bottles and objects at homes with mezuzot on the doors that were identifiably Jewish. We've seen people driving their cars or marauding through Jewish neighborhoods and yelling, "We're going to rape your women," right? Or yelling things like "Allahu Akbar," and literally then wreaking physical violence on people. And one of the incidents that was captured was in broad daylight in Times Square, a group of people beating and bloodying a Jewish man whose only crime was he was wearing a kippah, to the point where he was left unconscious in the street while people kicked him, you know, bloodied him with like a crutches. It was really quite disgusting. And to think that this is happening in America is really unconscionable.
So what do you attribute this to? I remember back during the Trump administration, you were quick to point out instances where you thought political language that fomented anti-Semitism. Do you see political leaders now who are exacerbating this?
Well, let's be clear. None of the people committing these crimes were wearing MAGA hats, right? The reality is I do believe that political language can have real-world consequences, but this is a very different kind of political language. So yes, we called out the prior president and his kind of acolytes, the extremists, from marching in Charlottesville to marauding through Capitol Hill. But in this case, we have people waving Palestinian flags and then beating Jewish people. And in this case, you know, what I might really draw a parallel to is the hate crimes committed against Asian Americans, where unhinged, you know, fictionalized conspiracies about China, first spouted by political leaders, led to real-world consequences as Asian Americans were attacked on the streets. Well, today we have unhinged, fictionalized conspiracies about Israel, that somehow the Jewish state is systematically slaughtering children or committing genocide. And then that leads to real-world attacks on Jewish people in the streets of America, on our campuses, in our communities. So although, again, the political tenor may be different, the real outcome is the same. And that's why we think people, regardless of where you are on the spectrum, need to speak out clearly and firmly and forcefully and say in an unambiguous way that anti-Semitism is unacceptable. Because, again, this isn't activism. It's hate, and it should be called out as such.
In that letter that you sent to the White House, you specifically asked President Joe Biden to speak out more forcefully. Have you heard from the White House since you sent them that letter?
We have been in touch with the White House. Look, and Joe Biden has been good on these issues his entire career, from his time in the Senate to vice president to now as president, he announced his run for office decrying the anti-Semitism that he saw, you know, in full view at Charlottesville. So just this morning, he tweeted out a firm statement we were pleased about. But we do think it's critical for the administration to stand squarely in solidarity with the Jewish community in this moment when so many of us are feeling frightened. I've heard from Jewish people across the country, and they are feeling scared. They have extremists on the right. They don't have these, if you might say, radical voices from the left. And they are wondering, is it safe for me to go out, you know, wearing a kippah? Is it safe for me to walk to synagogue on a Saturday morning? Again, this is in America in 2021. So we think leaders, not just President Biden, but members of Congress need to speak out and clearly and consistently call it anti-Semitism without making equivalence or excuses for any other form of prejudice. You can have fierce debates about Middle East policy, but that is not an excuse to assault and victimize Jewish people in America, in Europe, anywhere.
All right, Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
One way the Biden administration is trying to address the challenges posed by migrants crossing the southern border is by focusing on where the journey for many begins. The U.S. is offering incentives to Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico to better control their borders to stem the flow. Tanya Rashid and Neil Brandvold report.
It's been 8 days since Juan Guerra lost his job at a factory operating heavy textile machinery for Canadian apparel maker Gildan. He was among 12 workers fired without severance after protesting for higher pay. He barely survived on $12 a day to support his wife, who also lost her job at the same factory, his sister, and his 3-year-old daughter. After back-to-back devastating hurricanes that struck Central America last year, the family lost their home and belongings and had to move in with an uncle. And the last brutality. Shortly after that, Joan's father was murdered by gang members in an attempted robbery. At just the age of 23, Joan is a sole breadwinner for a desperate family.
It's really difficult since my dad died. He's been a father to us. Since he was 9 years old, he's worked for all of us and our mother. He's the one who raised us.
They live under constant risk in Chaloma, one of the most dangerous cities in Honduras, the murder capital of the world. Two gangs operate here, MS-13 and 18th Street, responsible for thousands of homicides this past year. Juan fears anything can happen to him at a moment's notice. He says his only way out is to go to the United States, where a very different world awaits.
I've heard from friends what you make in Honduras in 1 year, you make in 2 months in the United States. There you can go grocery shopping calmly. Here they will assault you or can even kill you. Life is so much better there for economic and security reasons. Everything is so much better.
Since February of this year, tens of thousands of Hondurans have organized on social media to join caravans heading north. They're hastily formed, and Juan received information to meet at 6 a.m. He shares his last dinner with his family before he sets off on his trek.
It's really difficult because people talk about how dangerous the road is. But with the trust in God, we know he will make it there okay.
The next day, several hundred people across the country took to the streets in the scorching sun, making their way to the Honduras-Guatemala border. Joan starts the first leg of his journey alone by walking, then hitching a ride on the back of a pickup truck where he meets a group of young men. For hours, they take whatever vehicle they could find. Along the journey, Joan's hopes seemed high that he would make it to a more welcoming America.
What do you think of President Biden?
From what I hear in the news, he's a better president. He'll give asylum. He will help. Not like Donald Trump, who didn't want anyone to enter. This president, from what I've seen, is much different than Donald Trump, and he's different in a way from migrants.
So you're confident you're going to get asylum?
Whatever happens, either I'll get asylum or I'll cross illegally. Whatever happens, the mission is to make it up north.
At the official border crossing, at the Honduras-Guatemala border, Hundreds of people arrive, many families, including mothers with newly born babies. Fights break out as several migrants are stopped by Honduran authorities.
We are not bothering anyone. I am paying with my own money.
What are the police saying to you?
That we should go back. We are migrants. They are saying, here is the border. This is the problems with the Guatemalans. They don't want to let us in. We are Hondurans. How can we be illegals in Central America?
Do you have documentation?
Yes, we have everything.
But they are not letting you pass?
They won't let me pass.
Frustrated families storm through and continue to walk. To avoid the military, Joan joins scores of migrants on an illegal path through the jungles to get to Guatemala. As they make their way, our team crossed official borders where we arrived to a dramatic scene.
The army are armed and vigilant. Because the government has declared a state of emergency, they have been given permission to use force on the migrants when they arrive.
This deployment of security forces comes in the wake of a recent agreement made by the Biden administration with the Central American governments to militarize the southern borders and to make the journey more difficult for migrants in this particular caravan.
So Mexico made the decision to maintain 10,000 troops at its southern border, resulting in twice as many daily migrant interdictions. Guatemala surged 1,500 police and military personnel to its southern border with Honduras. Honduras surged 7,000 police and military to disperse a large contingent of migrants.
As we drive through Guatemala, we see the Biden administration policy in coordination, as large groups of migrants are met with militarized checkpoints, stopping and detaining migrants along the track.
We're about 4 or 5 hours into the Guatemalan-Honduras border, and the army has detained about 45 migrants for illegally entering Guatemala. Many have been without food or water for 4 to 5 hours, and now they're about to be sent back to Honduras in trucks.
In just a matter of minutes, they are taken away. Later that night, we hear from Joan.
Just now, we received this video footage of him trekking in the dead of the night through the jungle. And he sounds out of breath and exhausted. And shortly after that, he just now sent a text message right after that video saying that he's really scared and that half of the people he was with were kidnapped. And now we've tried to get in touch with him. I've called him several times and we haven't heard anything back.
As we continue to wait for news from Joan, we come across reports of other migrants kidnapped from the same caravan, a common danger for many heading north.
So we just got word that Joan is nearby and he made it after all, and he's walking up right now. Is that him?
It is. And he tells us about his harrowing journey.
I was afraid because it was dark and there were three people that I didn't know, and I'm in a foreign country and it's definitely not a good reason they're waiting for me. It scared me even more because they kidnapped the other people. I was also really afraid when I crossed the river, and halfway across the river I was out of energy. But I prayed to God in the middle of the river that he would save me. The only thing that came to mind was the image of my daughter, and so that motivated me to make it to the edge of the river, and that's how I got out.
Joan tried to hitch a ride for the Guatemala-Mexico border with his group, but couldn't catch up to them on time.
Part of me is happy because nothing happened to me, like other people who leave the house looking for the American dream and they lose a leg on the train, or when they are trying to cross a river, what almost happened to me, and they drown. On one hand, I'm happy, and on the other hand, I'm really sad because I didn't reach my goal. Like they say, God knows what he does and why he does it. He has a purpose for every one of us. So that is the mission, to try it again. Maybe right now wasn't my moment to pass, but if it is God's will that I make it to the USA, then I make it.
Afraid to continue the trek alone, he has decided to return to Honduras, to rest, gather the strength and the courage to try again for the USA, for a better life for them all. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Tanya Rashid with Neil Brandvold in Guatemala.
The This week, as we mark 1 year since the murder of George Floyd, we look back to another police killing that changed the country. Nearly 7 years ago, 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. His death led to weeks of protests and sometimes violent clashes with law enforcement and gave birth to the Black Lives Matter movement. Earlier this month, Yamiche Alcindor spoke with Brown's father, Michael Brown Sr., about what has changed since his son's killing and George Floyd's murder.
Thank you so much for sitting down with us and talking. It's been nearly 7 years since your son was killed. I wonder how you're doing, how you've navigated this time.
Every day is still different. Sadly, this thing with community and police is still continuing. So it definitely does bring back up old feelings, open wounds, you know, brings that anger, that madness or whatever back.
So much has changed and so much hasn't changed since the death of your son. I wonder if you can talk to me a bit about where you were when you learned about George Floyd, if you saw the video and what that moment was like for you as a black man and as a father who had lost his son.
I was at home when it was going live on the internet. We all went to Minnesota to support and be down there on ground roots with the rest of the community. The energy reminded me of 2014. It was so much anger, pain. I met with the family, gave them words of encouragement, and I told them, anytime you want to reach out, just reach out. My phone will be on, because this is something that's going to be hurting for years to come, and you're going to try to understand why this happened to your family. So it's different stages with the trauma. You know, you got the denial, you got the anger, you got the trying to get past, and then you got coping.
Where are you in your stages?
Definitely not at the point of forgiveness. I would say anger / coping, but I'm in a space where I don't have to, I'm not around negativity to open those flames back up.
Where were you when Derek Chauvin was found guilty, and what went through your mind when you heard that family was going to get justice?
I was riding in the car and I heard it over the radio, and right then I was happy for the family. You know, but I know it's not satisfying for that family, because they still lost their loved one. People that lost that type of way, we're not satisfied. Until we start changing policies in different cities, some people will get justice, some people won't. You know, so that's what we're working on, changing some things here in Missouri, so another family won't have to go through this. I still got little small children. You know, I don't want them to go through nothing like that. I don't even think I'll be able to take that again. So it's all about the community and families, trying to make better things for families, you know, to be able to walk down the street, drive their car without being harassed or killed.
Thinking about your son, a teenager walking down the street, some people see that as a teenager walking down the street. Some people see that as someone who's threatening. We know that in this country, black men in particular, black people in particular, have been criminalized. How does that change?
Definitely profiling. Profiling has to stop. You have 16 to 18-year-olds that look like grown men from the back. So I think interacting with teenagers should be in a different tone, frame, whatever you want to call it, especially when they turn around and you see this baby face. Mm-hmm. There's no threat, you know. It's procedures that you can do. What's your parent's number, or where you're going, follow them home, talk to a parent. You know, it shouldn't have to end in death.
Do you think that what happened to your son, it ends up leading to the conviction of this officer and the murder of George Floyd? Do you think that momentum and where our country is played into that?
Of course. That's what I think. Some people might not, but that's what I think. Yeah. He opened up a lot of doors for a lot of families. So even the body cam, Mike started that, especially here in St. Louis. It was other places that was half of the police force had them, and not all, but now they almost everywhere.
What perspective could you share now that maybe you couldn't share in 2014? What perspective have the last 7 years given you as you think about where our nation is now with the death of George Floyd and the death of your son?
Well, I just say if we don't unify, we're gonna die. I don't care what color we is. You have white allies, you have all type of people that understand what's wrong. And if you support what you know is wrong, you're the problem too. You know, this is the only way this world can be better if we start understanding what the problem is. Mm-hmm. All of us is not the enemy, but we have been traumatized for so many years to where some people, you know, they don't know which way to go. So we have to have different conversations so we can try to work on, you know, doing something good or better for our community.
Undoubtedly, there will be more of these conversations happening this week and particularly tomorrow on the anniversary of George Floyd's death. Members of the Floyd family will meet privately tomorrow with President Biden at the White House. We'll have much more on all of this tomorrow night. It is a jam-packed week for United States senators, considering everything from China to Biden administration nominees, infrastructure money, and investigating January 6th. A perfect time for Politics Monday with Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and Tamara Keith of NPR. It is so good to see both of you on this Monday. And Tam, I want to start with you on the maybe not so glamorous but very important subject of infrastructure. The president, the administration has been talking about it for weeks. The president signaled in the last few days that he's prepared to accept a smaller amount of money from Congress. Where does it stand right now?
Well, and what was fascinating about the counteroffer sent out late last week by the White House to Senate Republicans who they're negotiating with was that they said, we will come down $500 billion on our proposal. So from $2.25 trillion to $1.7 trillion. But all of the items that they were willing to come down on were things where there actually is fairly broad bipartisan agreement that something needs to be done. So they took the areas of agreement and offered to come down on that, in a way, almost seeming like the point was just to highlight the vast disagreements with congressional Republicans. In the end, they still don't agree on the definition of infrastructure, how big the package should be, or how it should be paid for. And it's not clear how they're going to get there or if they're ever going to get there, though the White House is still at least publicly insisting that they are having these conversations, the conversations are continuing, and that they haven't given up yet on something bipartisan.
Amy, what is really going on here? Because I think a lot of people look at this and they say, hey, it's infrastructure. We know what infrastructure is. And we know, yes, the White House has tacked on some things that they say are important in terms of the social infrastructure of the country. But what is the nub? What is holding this up?
I mean, Tam laid it out really well. The definition, they don't agree on. The price tag, they don't agree on. They don't agree on how to pay for it. You know, other than that, they're really this close to getting bipartisan agreement. There's nothing they seem to agree on here. It seems like what the White House is doing right now is setting the groundwork here to be able to say when Democrats end up trying to pass something through a Democratic-only proposal through something called reconciliation, that they say, look, we tried. We want to be bipartisan. I brought all these Republicans, I'll list all the names and even, you know, the number of Republicans who aren't in leadership that he invited over to the White House. But, you know, we just couldn't agree. In many ways, this is about convincing some of the more moderate Democrats, especially somebody like Senator Joe Manchin, who has said out loud for many months that he wants to see more bipartisan cooperation on an issue like this. His colleague, his Republican colleague from the state of West Virginia, Shelley Moore Capito, also engaged in this process. So if they're able to convince Manchin that they've been working on bipartisanship, it didn't work, needs to pass on Democratic votes, then There we go.
So Tam, in a word, do we know whether the White House really wants a bipartisan deal or not?
Oh, man. I mean, they sure are putting on quite a public effort to try to get something. I think that they would love to have a bipartisan agreement that they could get through that was more strictly, narrowly defined as infrastructure, and then a much bigger package that they could push through reconciliation potentially. But they aren't there yet on even the things that they sort of agree are infrastructure, that Republicans largely would agree are infrastructure, like rural broadband, where they don't agree on the price tag.
It gives us a headache just thinking about it. But thank you both for trying. Amy, let's talk about the January 6th commission. This is something the Democrats very much want, a bipartisan commission. We know Speaker Pelosi has reworked it. It did finally a proposal pass the House. Now in the Senate, what does it look like? What are the pressures on Republicans, especially on those Republicans who did vote to impeach former President Trump over his role in the insurrection?
Well, it seems like what a lot of Republicans, especially on the Senate side, have made the choice that it's riskier to have the commission than to vote against a bipartisan commission, because the risk is that, once again, as we've seen in these last two elections, 2018 and 2020, if the election is a referendum on Donald Trump, if Donald Trump is the center of the conversation, the political conversation, that's not good for Republicans. You've heard folks like Susan Collins this weekend say, look, I'm all for having a commission. Here's the thing. I want to make sure that the report comes out at the end of 2021. In other words, I don't want this used by Democrats to hit us over the head in an election year. And even other Republicans in the Senate who had supported impeachment saying, look, we have so many other avenues to investigate this attack. We know the Justice Department is looking at this. We know that other committees in Congress are looking at this. I just don't think we need yet one more commission. But it seems fundamentally the worry is that that Democrats are going to use this to once again remind voters about what they didn't like about Donald Trump in an election year.
And Tam, we know it's not the White House that's necessarily behind this, but a lot of interest there in seeing it happen. What about the thinking on the part of Democrats broadly on this?
Yeah, I think that Democrats do want this to happen. If they didn't want it to happen, then I'm pretty sure that that Speaker Pelosi and the Democrats in the House would not have compromised so much on the design of this commission. But the reality is that they can keep investigating. It just won't have sort of the good housekeeping seal of approval of a bipartisan, nonpartisan commission. Instead, it could be a committee like that that investigated Benghazi, or I guess there were like five investigations of Benghazi, or it could be various House committees doing the investigations, but it just won't be bipartisan. It won't have that same approval. For Republicans, though, the other risk, it isn't just that Trump could go after the Republicans who voted for such a commission and exile them like he's trying to exile anyone who ever votes against him. But it's also just that the entire time that the commission is meeting, the former president could be making noise about it and drawing attention to it even more.
And in connection with all this, Amy, with the falsehood that the election, the November election, was rigged and that Joe Biden didn't really win, you have these audits going on in Maricopa County in Arizona. You have Georgia and other states looking at this. Do we see Republicans making headway on these efforts to, frankly, try to overturn the election still?
Right. I mean, Judy, what's worrisome about these is not that the election will be overturned. The election is over. The courts have weighed in, and the legal process has gone, has taken root. So it's done. The problem is that we know that many Republican voters, a majority of Republican voters, don't believe that the election results were fair, and that even the process itself for adjudicating disagreements is not trusted. These two states, Arizona and Georgia, are going to be battlegrounds for the foreseeable future. In 2022, they have Senate races that could determine the majority in the Senate. In 2024, we know there'll be battleground presidential states for the Electoral College. And what you have going on here is a complete undermining of trust, not just in the way the campaigns operated, but in the local officials. And Judy, we talked a lot about this in 2020, but how the guardrails of our democracy really were these local elected officials and the work that they were doing. Now even they are being undermined, and that's a very worrisome trend.
Never seen anything like it before. Amy Walter, Tamara Keith, we thank you both.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
Now, widening the lens to see more of art history. In the midst of the pandemic, the Museum of Fine Arts Houston opened a new building that highlights its growing collection of Latin American and Latino works. Jeffrey Brown visited recently for our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
Wire sculptures from the 1970s and 80s by the Venezuelan artist known as Gego, Gertrude Goldschmidt. Abstract paintings by several Brazilian artists in the 1950s. A 2017 installation holding the belongings of a deported migrant titled Temporary Storage by Mexican artist Camilo Ontiveros. Different shapes, styles, and forms, all part of a 20-year project to expand the story of art history. Now the Museum of Fine Arts Houston has a new showcase, the Kinder Building, designed by architect Stephen Hall, to house its collection of modern and contemporary art. And a full quarter of it, everywhere you look, is by Latin American or Latino artists. Curator Mari Carmen Ramirez.
That's a statement in itself, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And it's a statement that very few museums in this country can make.
And why is it an important statement for this museum, for you?
Because of the ascendance of the Latino population and other groups here in the United States. These are the populations that are going to be defining the future of this country, in my view. And so it's important for the museum to position itself in that debate. And then these are exponents of...
Since coming to the museum in 2001, Ramirez, who was born in Puerto Rico, has helped build an enormous collection of works little known to the American public and rarely seen in most U.S. museums.
What did you want people coming to this museum and Americans more generally to know about Latin American art?
I wanted them to know that Latin Americans were not just practitioners of 20th century art, that they actively contributed new ideas and new approaches. Because we have, in this field, we have been fighting from the very beginning against the notion that Latin American art is derivative of U.S. or European art, that everything that Latin Americans did was to follow Picasso or Mondrian or Rauschenberg or many of the artists. And that's a fallacy.
Americans might know the great Mexican muralists like Diego Rivera. And the painter Frida Kahlo is a phenomenon unto herself. But beyond Frida, the Houston Museum expands the picture dramatically to Brazilian abstractionists from the 1950s and 60s like Ligia Clark.
It is what she called a bicho, which is translated as critter. It is about the sensorial experience of manipulating the object.
And in a very different mode, there's the Argentinian Antonio Berni's painting with found objects, including street trash, a commentary on the migration of the poor from the countryside to the city.
But the idea is that this is the reality that these people live, and so what better way, you know, that to represent, you know, their plight, you know, than to use the same garbage and the same trash that they're exposed to every day.
The concern with social issues has continued in more recent years, as in Mexican artist Teresa Margolyes's harrowing Lote Bravo from 2005. 400 adobe bricks made from the earth where bodies of murdered women were found, the femicides in Ciudad Juarez.
She picked up earth from those places, and then working with an artisan, they produce these bricks. And they're
Each one represents a woman.
Each one represents a woman. You can think of it as a memorial, but you can also think of it as a cemetery.
A big focus for the collection now, art by American-born artists of Latin American descent, already numbering more than 400 works by some 70 artists, like Houston-based Vincent Valdez's painting of a young man suspended in the air from his series titled Stranger Fruit. Ramirez sees a vibrant and growing Latino art world, but one still in need of what she calls an infrastructure.
Galleries, museums, collectors, institutionalized study programs. Without these elements, you know, the art cannot flourish. I mean, it can flourish at the level, I mean, the artists are producing it, you know, but nobody's going to get to know what they're doing or to really understand its importance and its significance.
Do you see that changing, though?
Yes, I see that changing. I think the change is coming. It's going to take a while still, but I'm hoping that in 20 years, it will be in a different at a different level.
The Kinder Building opened amid the pandemic and amid a social justice movement that's led museums nationally to rethink their missions. The timing may have been serendipitous, but Ramirez says the effort here fits that larger reckoning.
Latin American or Latino art or African American art is not about a fad or a tendency or a trend or, you know, some fashionable movement that is in vogue right now. It's about the fact that museums really need to reinvent themselves, you know. They need to really reflect the demographics and the profile of the audiences that they are serving. This country is living a transformation, and museums need to position themselves, you know, to address that transformation.
A new world, just as artists like Argentinian Yula Kosige have long been dreaming of and creating. Now for all to see. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown from the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston.
As we reported, this week marks 1 year since George Floyd was killed. But what has changed in this year of protests and racial reckoning? On Tuesday night, we hope you will join us for an hour-long special on PBS, Race Matters, America After George Floyd.
In a year of racial reckoning, violence, abuse, and inequities persist.
We, the jury, find the defendant guilty.
The Chauvin verdict hinted at a path to justice. Yet much more is to be done.
Now's the time to act.
How can we create lasting change? Race Matters. America After George Floyd. A PBS NewsHour special report. Tuesday, May 25th at 10 p.m., 9 Central.
And you can watch the special report here on your PBS station, as you heard, at 10 p.m. Eastern. And join the conversation by following the NewsHour online. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.